Any other questions?
Would you care to discuss anything about the saint?
About the what?
The saint.
The saint? Well, of course, the Sphinx is a symbolic temple. It has its relationship to the Masonic Order. And there are areas of masonry that contain much about the Sphinx. And we can cite that as far as the builders of the pyramid are concerned, they built the Sphinx first, and then built the pyramid thereafter. They were dwellers of the city of An. And, of course, the temple of An and the peoples of An that originally settled there were divided by 12, and the area was allotted to them to live in according to their time and their measure. They built the Sphinx before they built the pyramid, and it was an incumbent line of the human head, and it signified, of course, the recognition that the line of the tribe of Judah would be the ruler of the nation. Actually, why the Egyptians did not know what the lion was, but the people that did know what the lion was, it stood for, were those that had built it. Never in all the areas of Egyptian history were they able ever to decipher their own lion, or did they understand what it was. The symbol of the mysteries of the pyramid have their sequel, of course, inside the Sphinx. There are 33 steps that lead down from the door in the front of the Sphinx, and there is an amphitheater that is held up by 10 pillars. And 33 steps, of course, are also equivalent with the 33 years of the life of Christ, as well as the amphitheater with the 10 pillars and the amphitheater with the 2 pillars. However, there's a smaller opening at the rear of the large amphitheater where they have the 10 pillars, and then this is a circular room, and it has 2 pillars standing within it, and this would be equivalent to the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, but they knew when they built the pyramid, of course, this was there. There was a passage that went from the back of the Sphinx up into an area of the pyramid. Now, this has been sealed from the time of the beginning. There's no way in which we can force its entrance. However, George Washington knew about the inside of the Sphinx, and he wrote a paper on the Sphinx. There was many things that have been said about the Sphinx, but nobody knows exactly all that is contained within it, except there were schools of Masonic thought that thoroughly understood the symbol of the Sphinx. Napoleon, of course, when he went down into Egypt, they fired shots with their artillery at the Sphinx, and they chipped off part of its ears and so forth, but the fact remains that that since this time, why the British government and the Egyptian government came together on the matter of the archaeology of the Sphinx, and they put it back together. The incumbent line of the human head is the guard to the pyramid as well, because it is the history of this emblem of the incumbent line of the human head, which was Christ, and the symbolism that it contained, of course, was the message which the pyramid also contained, only it was in greater detail inside the pyramid. The British will not permit, Egyptians will not permit anyone to excavate between the claws of the Sphinx. Except one time, why they had sand, which was low sand in Egypt, covering the two paws, except for the top of the paws. Now they have the excavation down almost to the level of the entrance chamber, and of course there is a small door at the base of the back of the Sphinx. But for some reason, why the British will not, or the Egyptians will not let anyone enter into it. So that's the story. The incumbent line with the human head and the carrying forward of the chambers inside of the Sphinx are only part of the mystery. These will intersect in the areas of the pyramid at a chamber which is known as a mystery chamber, and which is the chamber of the kingdom. This is taught and known and understood by those who have studied in the past on the Sphinx, and we might say that masonry since the days of George Washington down to our time has known that the Sphinx contained these chambers within it. The interesting portion of it is that if you took a map that was the size to work out in detail the inside of the outside of the pyramid, you discover that by placing the King's Chamber over London, that the pit is in Africa, And it also indicates that the meaning of the pyramid and the sphinxes was well known throughout all the years, that the Westminster Abbey was the house of God, and does cover the spot where the top of the King's Chamber would be. The King's Chamber is put over Westminster Abbey, right across the cities in Africa, and it lays out a rather interesting fulfillment in the passages of the pyramid. But I can't say any more than this. I know a little more, but this is all we can say at this time. Another question?
On the mountain overlooking Jerusalem, you talked about you would gather them as a hen gathers them.
Well, of course, as far as Jerusalem was concerned, Jerusalem was an ancient city, and it was the city which belonged to him as king, and he was properly the king of Palestine as well as Jerusalem. And of course, this was the ancient site for the temple as well as the site for the great honor guards that used to stand before King David, and he of course was David's greater king. And when Jesus looked upon Jerusalem, he said that he would that it would come to him and he would comfort it like a hen with a chick. But he said at the same time he realized that she would not. And so the reason for this was that the city of Jerusalem was filled with Amalekites and Hittites and Canaanites, and the Jews made Jerusalem their capital. The people that were true Judeans came willingly to Christ, but the majority of the people that dwelt in the city were built up by the Sadducees and by its kingdom. Now, Jesus wasn't lamenting the Sadducees because the Sadducees, he knew, couldn't accept him, wouldn't come, had no capacity to receive him, would not recognize the spiritual truth that was built around him, and was totally void of this. However, when Jesus looked upon the city, why, these words he cried out, because he was not without his human emotions. He knew that this was his city, and it was a part, of course, of the headquarters of the kingdom. But what Jesus made very, very clear that he did not anticipate that there would be any acceptance of him by the city at that time. And when the day comes that the city will, all that will be left will accept him, why, by that time there'll be a lot of them be missing. And of course, you can't speed that up. The Judeans themselves the people that live in Judea, even in this latter day, are made up of his enemies. And of course, it's not going to come in this period of time either until the thing comes to its climax. It isn't very far away, and they shall be destroyed and turned over, and the city will go through a great many changes, and they shall involve geology as well as the structure of its inhabitants. But the passage was only relative to what Jerusalem had been and what it was. And the people that were there now, they had no capacity to receive him. And he just made this statement. Is there another question?
In Carolyn's book on Alexander the Macedon, he said that the people in Carthage were Phoenicians, and also he claims that Phoenicians were descendants of the Canaanites, the rest of the God Dagon and Baal. I wonder if there's any basis for that.
Well, there's no basis of truth in this, because the people who were called Phoenicians were actually the sons of Enoch, and they were Phoenicians. This was a descendant line that came down through the house of Israel too, because when you come on down to the period of the Phoenicians, they referred to the Egyptians, not the Egyptians, but the peoples of Greece as the Phoenicians, and they were sons of Isaac and Saxons, and they considered themselves not only very, very vitally the part of the kingdom that so much did they feel this, that when Alexander the Great started out with his Macedonians, he tried to gather as many people as possible, and he sought to bring them all into one ten enclaves. In other words, he wanted all of the people that were of the seed of the kingdom or were of the white race to be brought together. When the people that he met on the plains of Chaldemir, because he went out to the Far East, while he met white Persians that came down from the north. He met the people that came down from the upper steppes that were Sethites, and he, remember, asked them all to join him, and that they could keep their own religion, they could keep any facets that belonged to their background, but that they were the ones that were referred to as Phoenicians, and he called them the Phoenicians. He said in his study that he had studied out carefully the origin of nations, where they had come from. And so with this in mind, why he was out to build the white race. Now, Alexander was not an ideal person in some areas because he did involve himself in wild orgies and so forth, but they were largely the result of his having, he went into ancient Babylon, he went into Media Persia, and then he went into these areas of the steppes, and in these bouts that he had, he was very much temperamental. Of course, he became more so as the years went by. When he conquered portions of China, he thought that he had now broken the last of the races, and people were still pouring through out of the steppes, but he would not turn and go through the steppes to fight them, because he said if the steppes can release this many people, then if one went over in their land, they would be surely swallowed up. But Alexander the Great died, as you know, on his way back before he reached the land of Greece, and it was a rather strange story that he should recognize so easily and so quickly that the white races belonged together. But they were called Polhenok, and that all the sons of the white race were known as Phoenicians at that time. And this is an area of error where they make a statement that these Phoenicians were not were actually worshippers of Baal, because these people didn't worship Baal. In fact, in the Zoroastrians, they not only followed a service that was exactly like that service which the children of Israel had, in which they recognized that God was one. They recognized that God meted out areas of chastisement, but they believed that he gave eternal life. They believed that he enveloped them in power and in life, and at no place where they without this light. And so the Zoroastrians believed that Zoroaster was his prophet, and that they could go forth and fight all those that opposed them, but they made no offer to fight those that were willing to worship their God. This may have been weakness on the part of the Zoroastrians, but they said that God is everywhere, that God sees all things, but we are his sons. So this again marks them as men who had not gone back into the steppes, whereas they came down out of the steppes and out of the place where our race originally was begotten, and out of the genealogy that we find the people that came to Persia, some of them going to India, some of them going into Europe, had gone earlier when they built Doreg, as well as the Stonehenge, and of course the other spots that were north of India and in Burma. So you see, they had the same knowledge, they were the same people, and though Alexander brought some of them together, he had little knowledge as to how much they were the same people. Another question?
I understand,
but
this is the term Phoenix, the combination of
Phoenix
and Noah.
Well, I would say that Phoenix came from Phoenix, when in 812 B.C., why the children of Israel, or some of the children of Israel, sailed westward, and they came to the Caribbean Sea, and they went into Central America, and during that time, why they went ashore, and they were preaching the gospel, that is such gospel as they had to this hour, looking ahead to the great white dog that would come, and of course they were not as far off in their caricatures of it, because they thought that when he came, he'd be Messiah, and that he would give life to men, and that he was the redeemer that they were looking for. And of course, This is the reason why the people that are in the Maya lands, and as well as in the Tuatec lands, why they received these people when they came, and they made virtual gods out of them. They permitted them to use their responsibility when they came there as teachers, and they let them teach, and they let them dwell in their city. And of course, the Mayans had no armies at this time, and they had not engaged in any major conflict with anybody. And after our race appeared down there, why, the emblem of the Kohinoch, one of the things that they took was a bird that was symbolized like a peacock with all the emblems, with all the glory and so forth. And they stayed the Manasseh-ites. These were a portion of Manasseh. This is when Manasseh went to sea on the ships of Dan. Actually, the ships of Dan and were in the Mediterranean as well as in the outside, and they some of the Greeks provided the sailors for these ships, and Manasseh, who had gone out early, did the traveling. So then from the land of the north, the Asiatic Indians came down, and they wanted to destroy these Indians, especially the lighter ones, and so they brought their weapons for their destruction. And they encircled the city of the Mayas, and they used around the outside of the city great piles of sulfur. And they had located various deposits of it as they went along. Prior to this time, nobody used sulfur, and they put the sulfur pit high around the outside of the city of the Mayas, and the peoples inside could not seal up the city from the fumes, but they could go down, and they could come out through these underground caverns. So it brought the Mayas and the Manasseh-ites out behind the columns. And they went out, and they continued northward into the areas where the Tuatec finally built the civilization. The people continued to set high mounds of burning sulfur, and many of the people were overcome that read it. And then afterwards, they broke their way into the Mayan city. There wasn't any Mayas there at all, nor did they know where they had gone. And they had lost something like 2 weeks' time, and they had gone northward into the area of the Tuatec. And they were a nomadic Indian for a time. Then they continued far to the east and to the north, and the Aztecs also had the phoenix bird, and they had some stories of this trail of remembrance. Of course, we do not know today but what the strongest of the old teachers of the Aztec tribe were not themselves Israelites, because the white Cherokee was Israel, there were white Apache that were Israel, and then there were these dark Indians that came down from the northern parts of the country. And so the Mayan was never given an identity with Israel, but he kept Israel alive while he was there, and Israel went out of there, that is, the tribe of the Manasseh being Israel, had gone out of there and produced different tribes in the southern part of the United States, in the northern part of Central America. And wherever you see them, you'll note that these white men had forbidden any area of sacrifice except to the one God. And at the time that they called for sacrifice, it is true today that that sacrifice was an atonement. More than that, we have the Quiches. Which Quiches were found among some of the southern Indians, and the Quiches were actually also the tribe of Manasseh, and they talked about how they had come across the ocean, how they'd come far, and that they were going to go back. Now, they never made it back, and they never sailed back, but the Mayans again reformed those that had gone to the south, and they always looked for the return of this tribe of Manasseh. And when it came, they said it would be the end of the age, and it would be the coming of the Messiah God. When when Cortez landed in Mexico, why, the words had reached the peoples that were Indians and the peoples that were not, peoples that were of the tribes of the now growing to some size, and whose progeny, of course, made part of the tribes of North America. At this time, remember that they wanted to do and under Cortez was to carry a message that the king of Israel or the king had come, and little did he realize that white Indians or that white men had been there before with a message, but that they wanted to tell them about Christ, and they wanted also to gather all the land they could for this area. Now, there was a group of Negroids that came up out of the areas of the sea, the Caribbean Sea, and had fused themselves in with some tribes that existed in the south. And they had no love at all, of course, for Cortez and the white men, so they started liquidating Cortez's military. And of course, when the Indians started liquidating Cortez, why, Cortez became crueler than he was, and he ordered the Simeon charge, of course, which means that that only those Indians that that became the servants of the Cortez were permitted to survive. So when they got down to South America, why, the Aztecs were powerful too, and he found that they received him with as though he were a king, and they bowed before him and thought he was the coming of Christ because they had been taught this. And he said, no, Christ had come in the past, and had come about 800 years, or about, at the time, of course, that he entered into it was about 1,200 years, but he knew then that these people had been told about 800 years before Christ that Christ would come. And so he went down, of course, as you know, all the way to the Inca, and he carried his treasures back, and of course they fought over these treasures, and many of them stayed in the islands of the Pacific because they were brought there and taken by pirates that were dwelling in those Pacific islands, because the people that had the root in the cities of the Caribbean, and they had quite advanced cities by now, some of them were from Cortez's own band through the years, and others of them came from failings that had occurred from other nations. But the as far as the people concerned who were with the Mayans, why, they were Israel.
In regard to the same subject, Dr. Smith, the Mormons, in addition to Manasseh, they put Levi in as part of this Manasseh tribe that came over. Is that correct?
Of course, some Levites came with Manasseh, because Levi was given to every tribe. And he was the minister, and Levi became the minister of every tribe. In fact, I wouldn't give very much for a minister that wasn't of the house of Levi, because Levites are scattered among the tribes. And I think the difference between the called ministry and the uncalled ministry is actually whether or not they did come from Levi or didn't.
Yeah. There was a white Christian king that ruled in the area that's now in India that was put slain by Genghis Khan. His name was King David, and some is part of the least seems to think, or the translation seems to think, that he was a son of Prester John. Do you know anything about it?
Well, as far as the areas of India, or rather the East are concerned, most of the areas of the East were referred to as the India state.
It was the lower, in that area, somewhere not far. I put it on the map as far as India.
Well, this is most likely because when Genghis Khan stepped out to the steppes and across China, he came against strong white Aryan societies that existed in India. And this is about the year 10, and of course, the year 1011 is actually the proper date. And I don't know whether or not this was the son of Prester John or not. And I think that people will be surprised to find that Prester John is still alive, still preaching, and will be when Jesus comes. For if I will, that thou should follow me, what is that? And if thou should remain, what's that to thee? In other words, Jesus turns to Peter, and he's rather short with Peter in this particular passage, because dealing with a mystery, and we'll look at it here for a moment. Now, verily I say unto you, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself, and thou walkest where thou wouldest. When thou shalt be old, thou stretchest forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee where thou wouldest not. And now, up here prior to this, when Jesus is dying, let's see, Jesus said to Simon Peter, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He said unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. and he said unto him, feed my lamb. And he said to him again, second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And he said to him, yea, Lord, thou knowest I love thee. And he said unto him, feed my sheep. Then he said unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? And he said, Lord, thou knowest all things, knowest thou that I love thee? And Jesus said, feed my sheep. And within this instant, Peter turning about seeth the disciple which Jesus loveth, following, leaned on his breast at supper, and said unto him, where is he that betrayeth thee? And Peter seeth him, saith to Jesus, what shall this man do? And Jesus said, if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee, follow thou me? Then went this saying abroad among the brethren, that the disciple should not die. Yet Jesus said not unto him, he shall not die, but if I will that he shall tarry till I come, what is that to thee? This is the disciple which testifieth these things, which wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Therefore, there are as many also other things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written, every one, I suppose, the world itself could not contain the book that should be written. In other words, we have reason to believe that the last three verses were not the verses put in there by the writer of the book. First place, because they go back with a reflection over what had been said, and whereas it is perfectly plausible that John would say that the saying went abroad among the brethren that the disciple would not die, and Peter, and rather John, just wanted to discount it. But the next verses after this were not written by John because somebody else thought they needed a better explanation than John ended his gospel with. Is there another statement or question?
Well, this same translation had an account of Alexander the Great bottling up an army of Gog, which they referred to as Jewish tribe. And the steps of Asia, so there's certainly some ancient evidence that Gog comes from the steps of Asia.
That's right, and Gog is the name given the prince of the land of Russia. And of course, Alexander the Great hated the Russians, or hated the people that came down out of the land where the Russians came from. As far as his behavior is concerned, I can't find too much evidence that Alexander the Great died with drunken fit. He did die of a seizure, and he, of course, did almost all of the history which he entered into was done before he was 32 years old. So. And he was a magnificent conqueror. We'll just have to say that everywhere he went, he let the people go, and he permitted them to celebrate their own religion, as long as when they celebrated that religion, it was not offensive to the one God. Now, there's one thing about Alexander the Great. He became aware that God was one, and he celebrated people with one God. He trusted them more with one God. They had two gods, well, they weren't permitted to carry on the service and the worship of two gods.
When I was in school, I majored in ancient history. And in the history books that I read at that time, Russia, under the Tsars, was a very, very Christian religious country. And yet the books that we read today, or most of the stuff that we get today, put the Tsars as real tyrannical rulers, and they kept the people in complete subjugation and so on and so forth.
Well, of course, you must realize that Russia contains about 57 varieties of Mongols, along with the segments of Christians. And as far as the Tsar and the Tsarina were concerned, why, up until the end, they were a very Christian people. And they were of the Greek Orthodox Church. When Germany sent the princes into Russia, Germany sent these princes in to hold back the Tsar Khans of Russia. And in order to hold it back, why out of the strips of Germany, they called for volunteers. And so the 10 princes of Germany, they provided the manpower for the original army. And they went in and fought a rather long war. And after some 32 years of battling and harassment, why, they put a Tsar on the throne. And then with it came a Northern European migration. Germans came in and and the Danes went into with the Russians, and there came up from the south, from areas of Greece and from Romania, and where the where in all the areas of the Slavic peoples, they came and they decided that they would now expand because they had a Christian king, and they became quite a powerful nation, and everything went along real well. Now, it's true that many of these people came with nothing, and they were given serfdoms all over. In other words, they were permitted to raise grain and to build their homesteads, and they had to give a percentage, something like 30% of what they raised went to the king for the maintenance of his army, for their protection, and so forth. However, it was quite a function in coming around to take the taxes that, that the king's men they apportioned them. They took the taxes. If a farmer wasn't doing so good, well, they left him alone. And if another farmer had a big yield, well, they took 30% of it and so forth. And the serfs were unhappy with the Tsar. In fact, there never was any unhappiness in Russia until it came from the revolution. The industrial areas of Russia, with the coming of machinery, were very small. And they actually, when Marx and Lenin started out their revolution, well, they were trying to whip up the people into a revolution, and they couldn't get any cooperation from the serfs. And people had their farms all around Russia. In fact, Russia would never be a leading kingdom. It would always have been a rural kingdom because they were only set upon that type of economy. And the steppe was so large and so great that the Doans and that rode north, and the Rockabatali and the Batali themselves were Mongols, and then there was the Plata-Mongols and so forth. Well, there happens to be about 11 tribes of the Mongols across the steppe, and besides the varying degrees of closed cities and everything else that existed out in the steppes of Russia. So when Russia gained its great strength, why, it would put this down. Now, as far as having a good army, well, the army of Russia was pretty good, but it was only big enough to stop an uprising in Russia. It never was big enough to go outside. The fact is that they could have fought a war, it would have been to keep the enemy out of Russia rather than to expand. But the Tsar was not always aware that the revolution had gone deep into the part of his country because they had brought so many of these people who were Cathars and others into the fight. Actually, the Marxist rabble were not the serfs and were not the actual peoples that did the farming. And in fact, some of the people that did the farming in Russia were quite wealthy, and many of the German princes had hundreds of little serfdoms, and they dwelt in Russia. And they lived in Russia and were satisfied with the Tsarton king because they were the nobility of the land. And yet each of these serfs was happily toiling away in his peasant way, and they turned over a percentage of the crop, and they in turn turned it over to the king. Everything would have gone on all right, but the world was growing up on the outside. And the advance of Russia compared to the advance of England or Germany or some country that was contemporary was really vastly different. Because it was almost a farm community that had this revolution taken by surprise.
I saw a picture in a magazine recently of the Red Army with a real close-up of a full company of men. And it's awfully hard to tell a book by cover, but I took a magnifying glass and looked at the faces of these men, and they appeared to me to be a white Christian type.
In what army?
In the Red Army, the Russian Army.
You mean that when Germany, when Russia was taken over?
No, this was just recently. It was during some celebration they were having in Red Square, and it was in color. I was quite impressed because you hear that there's a when Russia really gets in trouble, they bring in the Mongolians.
They do.
Generally speaking, you got a different group that they show. We show to the West.
Well,
I'm just wondering. These men just look to me to be white, like.
Well, of course, basically they have the Mongolian troops, their crack troops, and they're ruthless. They may have a show regiment that they have standing out in front. They might be polluted blood at best.
Well,
There's no white Russians in the West, you know. The fellows that are running the show are not white Russians, they're white Jews.
Yes, they are. These men don't look like them.
Well, but they are. I mean, there might be a few scattered people, you know. You might have caught a picture which they would like to show, of course, would be the ones that make it look like they're white, but even so, the people that are there are very implacable people. They're utterly ruthless.
You sure don't see those people when you see pictures of the people on the street. They're all about square-faced Mongol, every one of them.
That's right. Of course, they have preserved a form of a church, too, you see. There's a few thousand people left in Russia that they see particularly preserved in order that they can go through their own rites with all the integrity which they desire, and the enemy knows they can't do anything, and they keep their eyes on them for anything that might be subversive, and this is where the church gets its play, that the ministers that are ministering to them are ministering to them cold and calculated. But the people are so glad to get into religion that they make one of these phony churches before them. So this is another factor that does exist.
Wouldn't you expect
that
Queen Elizabeth being a
Queen Elizabeth
would know about Danger? And how
do
you explain
her
statement in regard to Danger?
Well, don't be too sure that you're getting Queen Elizabeth. In other words, the Senate is, or rather the House of Lords and the House of Parliament, by many differing opinions. To them, of course, it is a revolt against the crown, and this cannot be. The crown says thus and so, and they're supposed to do it. However, Queen Elizabeth has hesitated somewhat, and if he hasn't, nobody can quote Queen Elizabeth on this policy. So, in fact, she can't dissolve the crown.
Some of her comments have been that she is for integration and so on. And does she know the
Kingdom? No, I don't think so. No, I don't think she knows it at all. However, integration in the sense to which she is speaking out is one thing, and annihilation is another. She doesn't want to see the white people of Rhodesia annihilated. But this is what certainly happened if the white government of Rhodesia has ever turned over to the Negroes. Of course, it's not really important what she thinks and what she does, because a better king is going to take over there someday. But she'll hold it, and it'll still stay alive until she comes. Until he comes. But there'll be some significant things connected with the turnover and the things that are going to happen when it does. But I don't think you have to worry about Rhodesia. I don't think you have to worry about South Africa, because these countries are more firmly entrenched in than you think.
There was also sometime back comments that they are preparing a place for the royal family in Canada. Is this biblical?
It's biblical that they were preparing a place for the royal family in the one great war. Now, we haven't had it yet, but if Russia suddenly were to swoop down with everything she had on Germany and on England, that they intended to bring the Queen and all of the sacred instruments and so forth that were a part of the ceremony over to Canada. It was over here once before, and when this transpired, of course, people didn't know that the throne and all the things with it were in Canada, but it was taken back again to Britain after the war. But I think that you're going to see again that I call all Israel together in one place. I think that it could come over here very, very quickly, and I think it will. However, we are going to win that war, and we are going to save Germany, but it will be it'll be battlefield X, I can tell you that.
Typically, then you feel that the 2000s will be on the continent.
That's right.
How true
it
is, can you make it?
How
long that'll be?
Well, I'll tell you, with all the things that are developing, I would say 2 years. 2 years. What could be shortened for your lecture? Is there another question?
What will happen with NATO now that France is...
Well, I think it's a real fine thing for France to get out of there. I never cotton very much to France. France is a rather sad spot because it has a lot of good people in it, and it's got a lot of people that have been so filled with wine that they have no resistance left. And that, you know, there's one thing that they, the spot where people drink the most, the sweetest wine that brings their senses to the to complete submission, is in France. Muscatel is the wine they like to drink, and it's the wino's wine. You just can't imagine what France is like anyhow. And in the last few years, it has deteriorated since the war, so far and so fast, until the streets of France and in Paris look like modern beatniks. And the beatniks are everywhere. You see them in France. In fact, they can't take a fast photograph of the population on the street and not bring out the beatnikism of Paris. So this is, there are some fine people. There are some people who work in farms and live in the mountains and live in Burgundy and in the various areas of France. There are some Normans and of course there are Benjaminites. They will remain separate and distinct till the end. But France, while basically a white country, it's just over the line and that's all. There has never been so great a mixture of races and peoples as there has been in France. And the men that looked held out for racial self-respect and carried the line, why, were men like Clemenceau and others that were Pétain and so forth. And of course they, this fellow that's the head of France, he's a white man, but you know his senility is playing on him, and the rascals that run the show are just taking advantage of this. I don't think that he's real sharp at all.
Do you think the girl is really a hard man? I thought he was a mindless.
We can't tell. He looks typically French. I mean, I think he's white enough. Yeah. Well, Mr. Johnson wouldn't be proud of that, but he's getting kind of disturbed with it. Is there another question?
Can Mr. Johnson take that he's going back to Texas?
Well, I guess he can. I think that Dallas will keep him alive in spite of himself, you know. However, I look for something else to happen in Dallas one of these days. And this will be done by the left wing, but I look for something to happen in Dallas. You can't talk too openly today, because if it happens, then you're in trouble. Another question?
This might be changing the subject a little bit, but a week ago on Saturday, I listened to Joe Pine's show, and he had Reverend Black Swagger on there, I believe he's in the mic. And he hadn't seen his face either. I wonder if there was any validity to that.
Well, now, I would say this. I don't know who this man was. I hope he gave a good account of himself. But there has never been any period of time when faith healing or healing was not a reality, because sin, sickness, and death are the outcome of violations of divine law, or someone violated divine law. Maybe not the individual who taught it, but the processes of the atonement cover sin, sickness, and death. So therefore, when the scripture says by stripes you're healed, it also relates that that you have vitality and you have the processes of the atonement reaching you. In other words, you can pray for the sick, and if you ask anything in my name, I will do it. This is in the 14th chapter of John, and you can be assured that Christ will perform. Now, someone says, well, I prayed and I didn't get the answer. Well, you didn't expect to get the answer. If you will pray in faith believing, well, you'll get the answer. And as far as faith is concerned, faith means just that too. That means that you believe God, that you believe Him ultimately. And you know, faith doesn't want to see a doctor. Faith wants to go more than this. Faith wants to claim the healing power of Christ, and it works. So I have witnessed many faith healings. We have prayed for people in our congregations for years, and when we've prayed for them, in most instances they have been healed. And so we didn't expect they wouldn't be healed anyhow, and said that that the same thing happened to me as happened last time. So they didn't expect it, and they didn't get it. But generally speaking, when a person comes for a prayer for healing, why they receive it. And generally why, after they have been healed, why they don't think anything about it because they feel better. And so that's the way it goes. But the thing is that the faith healing has been working, and of course it works more and more as we come towards the end of the age, because God poured out more of His Spirit upon His ministers for this type of prayer.
Isn't it true that a lot of people have lost faith in faith healing because of some of the almost charlatan type antics of some people that claim to be preachers, and they make it look absolutely ridiculous?
Well, I think possibly that some people maybe lost faith in it. Of course, a lot of them never had it offered to them either. You know, they didn't have avenues of opportunity because their church didn't specify that it believed in faith healing. But I would say that we just believe in healing, period. In other words, we don't have to classify it. We don't have to call it by some special name. You know, we've never gone out with a practice of a big fanfare because we thought that all this was unnecessary. It isn't important that there be 500 people present to see 5 people healed. In other words, God can heal you in your home. He can heal you where you sit. He can heal you without a big demonstration. And there's no reason why this should be done. But these so-called faith healers, they like to make a big stress out of it. And so they put a big ad in the paper, "We're going to pray for their healing today. And everybody that's sick, come down here." And of course, why the sick all come down, and the people have a big circus almost, because this man's got a broken leg, and this man's got a weak back, and this man's got a weak head, and so forth. And so they pray for all of them, and then suddenly the person whose leg has been getting better gets up and he walks out, and the person who is feeling pretty good, well, 90% of his ailment was in his head anyhow, and he gets better, see. But this type of meeting was not held. In other words, they brought the sick to Jesus because they had a need, and he'd be preaching the message, and when they get through, there'd be a lot of people, maybe they were around, they said, "Heal me," and Jesus would, the presence of the Lord was there to heal them. It's like the man that they lowered through the roof. They lowered a man through the roof at the feet of Jesus, and it says, and the presence of God was there to heal him. And so he just told him to take up his bed and walk, and he took his bed up and walked, and he said, when the rest of them said, "Well, now, would it be better to say, that he was healed?" Well, he said, "Why do you tell this man to take up his bed and walk?" Well, Jesus told him told them that they didn't understand, that the fact was that, as far as he was concerned, that this man wanted healing, so he told him to take up his bed and walk. He said, "Thy sins be forgiven thee," and he forgave sins. And they did go to jabbering among one another, because these Pharisees couldn't understand how this could be. But the fact is that they saw the man get up and walk out with his bed. Another instance, he'd be walking along as we see in the woman touched him, and she had this issue of blood for 7 years. And they knew that if she could lay her hand on Christ, she'd be healed. And so he turned and said, "Who touched me?" Well, what an amazing thing in a crowd as big as that was. And yet Jesus knew who touched him, and this woman said, "Yes, he touched him." As your faith, so be it unto you. And he healed her. But there were a great many cases where Jesus healed the sick, but he didn't put on a big fanfare. It was just he did it here and there. The really miracles of he opened the eyes of the blind, he unstopped deaf ears, and he would do it today if there were people around him that needed their ears open, their eyes and their eyes were not seen, and he would give them vitality and health. And he has commissioned his ministers to do the same thing. In other words, this not a show, this a vital work of power. Well, we have witnessed healing where they had great services, and certain numbers were healed. We have witnessed healing where there have been no services, and a certain number were healed. So I'm convinced that the services that making a special divine healing service only attracts attention to the areas of the phenomena. And it's very possible, of course, in this phenomena that you'll have 50% of the people who are sick in their head anyhow. And when they think that they're healed, they're healed. And so this gives a 50% healing to the minister that was praying for them. I believe in divine healing. I believe that if you have a right to it, and I don't say that we should replace doctors, because there's a lot of people that don't believe, and they need doctors. And there's lots of things that you can't do without the people's cooperation. But as far as healing is concerned, why, it's there.
There's quite a bit said about the end time, about miracles being performed by demons.
Demons cannot perform miracles.
Well,
so demons cannot perform miracles. They can't heal. They can do tricks, but they can't heal.
Well, two great signs and wonders, that's right.
Well, yes, but you see, the signs and wonders are not good. In other words, a man can climb up a rope and disappear in the air, say. They do that in India, and it's an illusion. It's a good one, say.
I do too.
But I mean, when you get through with it, there's a lot of things that can be done that are signs and wonders, lots of illusions, and lots of these things are classified as magic, but they're all floating. And when you get through with it, why, these things don't amount to much. I don't know the best doctors that I know, they're not opposed to divine healing, and I have a great number of doctors that in our own congregations, and they do their best for the person, and they each one will be carrying out the area of therapy that he thinks is best. And there are some people that would die with this because they're just not taking a hold, and yet the same person may be healed with divine healing. It may work. And it's dependent sometimes on the individual and his attitude. But all of these things are working piles of salvation to the individual. In other words, it does something to him. And I don't tell people to stop going to doctors. I don't tell people to that they should themselves abandon doctors. But I am saying that there comes an area where they can ask for prayer and they can be healed. And I don't think you have to go to the doctor with every headache, and I don't think you have to go to the doctor with every broken leg either. But the fact remains that that where it's possible to get your leg fixed, you get it fixed. Where it's not possible, you don't. Then that God can heal it. There's no doubt of this, you see. Because he that put it together in the first place can put it together right the second time. Another question?
Switzerland.
Well, now I'll tell you, Switzerland is with Germany, and it is part of the tribe of Gad. And Switzerland originally came from a breaking away, a small group of Germans that broke away and went up into these mountains. And there is more marriage between Swiss and Germans than any people on the continent. They didn't have anybody else part of it. But Swiss are Germans.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, well, they're predominantly German. Another question?
Why don't you give us one of your real good answers to a question we haven't thought of?
How about that? Well, I was giving you a chance. I've been answering questions from the air. And we have them stacking up high because they're coming in from the air. People wanting answers to questions. Tonight I thought I'd let you answer ask your own questions because it was much simpler.
Would you comment
on this is in the book of Revelation. All right. Now, which where did you find that? All right. That's here. All right. No.
Do you have names of 12,000 from
where it's from? Let's see here. Now, that's over in the sixth chapter. Yeah, I didn't think of it. Now, I heard the number of them that were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of Israel. Now, 144,000 is not a total number. 144,000 is a symbolic number. And so it's the square of 12. They carried out to 1,000. But it could be carried out to 1,000 times 1,000 times 10,000 times 10,000 as far as that's concerned. In other words, every individual that is in the structure of the kingdom is sealed. Out of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000, the tribe of Reuben 12,000, the tribe of Gad 12,000. This goes down through all the children of Israel. After this, I beheld all a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and peoples and tongues, that stood before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands. And he says, salvation to our God, which sitteth upon the throne unto the Lamb. So this again is the continuity of the remnant sealed out of Israel. Actually, after this I beheld a great multitude which no man could number. No man can number this, because this is carrying the urge of the identity out. And whenever you get 144,000, this is a symbolic number. You will note that over in the book of Jude, when it says the Lord will come with 10,000 of his saints in judgment, and this is another one of those symbolic numbers. It's the 12 apostles squared thing, and then by 1,000, and it's the 12 tribes of Israel squared, the apostles, or rather the 12 tribes of Israel as the ancient patriots of the Old Testament. When all of their descendants are gathered out, you know as well as I do that they're not 12,000 each tribe, see? But there are many times that today. So this is what it meant at this time, 10,000 of each tribe. Now, another place where it mentions this, it refers to them as men virgins. And this again shows the impossibility of this passage, because, in other words, it is 144,000 people carried out to the end of the tribulation, many, many thousands who have not bowed the knee to Baal. In other words, these people, spiritually energized, spiritually empowered, do not bow the knee to Baal. And as far as the people being virgins is concerned, well, of course, this is only a symbolic statement.
And they omitted in the tribe of Dan. I wonder if there was a reason
for that. No, I don't think there is. They admitted both sons of Joseph, but they omitted the tribe of Dan. I don't think there was any word, any reason for it. I think if you went back through the passage, why it shows by 12 tribes, it's all of Israel's embodied. And I don't, I think that inside of Revelation, I don't think it's totally accurate. In other words, what they intend, they didn't realize that they had omitted Dan when they did. And Dan is Dan's land, Dan Mark, Dan, and it's no less Christian than any other of the tribes of Israel. And it's just the way it happened. In other words, I think that they just made an oversight. In fact, I don't think originally they were admitted. I think in the translations of time they were admitted. But I can't hear you. Well, I can show you some for Judah and for Manasseh too. So this is of no importance. There's no significance here because Dan is well marked as one of the tribes and houses of Israel. Another question. Now, one thing I would say about this, that when in the book of Revelation it goes all out to show the 144,000, and then when it goes over to another place and refers to them as these are the men virgins, of course, you know, that Jehovah's Witnesses make a tremendous lot of this. They come around and they watch it. They'll tell you that every Jehovah's Witness becomes 144,000. And so I asked last when it came here and started out with this. I said, now, are you sure that I can make it? You know, if I come at Jehovah's Witness, oh, yes. He says, you can make it. He says, this is what it would take. Well, I said, just a moment. And I went and got a World Almanac that was about 67 years old. And I said, way back here, this World Almanac, you had over 1 million at that time of Jehovah's Witnesses. In fact, they estimate you here is 1.5 to 2 million Jehovah's Witnesses. And here you're telling me that you're going to get me in 144,000. Now, how are you going to condense this 144,000 down to the numbers you've already have? And I said, now women couldn't get in at all, could they? Because they're not men virgins. What are these men virgins anyhow? And so they got pretty well caught up there. He didn't know what to do with it. It was kind of a spot. And I said, you're going to have to kill off a bunch you got, or else you're going to have to throw a bunch of them out so you can keep taking in new numbers. See, you explain this to me. And I said, then from here on, why, I said, I'll listen a little to you. And they hemmed and hawed, and they said, well, they'd be back. But they never came back. They took off on a dead run. But the actual symbolism of this is where the language is crude, because it isn't sufficient. Women are in this number, but so I call the men virgins. They are, and yet under the Old Testament, they didn't count women. But in the book of Joel, I'll pour my spirit out on my sons and my daughters, and so forth. So women are in this 144,000. It's symbolic. It's all of the house of Israel. And this is what it takes. Now, here in the passage, there are those who think that it's different from the other passages that follow. But after this, he says, after this, now in your Bible, there's no division. And after this, look, I looked and beheld a great multitude which no man could number of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues stood before the throne, before the Lamb, and they cried, salvation to our God. And the angels stood around the throne, about the elders, the four beasts, and fell before the throne on their faces, worshiped God, saying, amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be unto our God forever. And one of the elders answered and said, what are these that are arrayed in white robes, and whence do they come? And I said unto them, sir, thou knowest. And he said, these are they which come out of the great tribulation, have washed their robes, and have made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And so again, they shall no more hunger, neither shall they thirst, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. For yet the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them and shall lead them into the living. Of course, this is all symbolic of the fact that a great number of people die in the intervening period. We've had a lot of people die already. We've had them killed all day long by the Russian hordes and so forth. And these people that were not established as a specific number, but he's talking about the end of the age. He sees a great number of the living, and he squares it by the square of Israel. There's no, it's a big square, and it's much handier to square it out as though each one was equal, but it's merely a form of showing that all Israel was there. All Israel shall be saved, as it is written. We got time for one more question?
The president of his royal majesty in Zambia is a fellow by the name of Kenneth Kawanda.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a recent article that this Negro king, whoever he is, requires Bible reading of 3.5 years of drugs every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, in light of the fact that Zambia has shown some opposition to Rhodesia, which is immediately south of it, and he's also a member of the organization, the African Unity, to how it's whether or not this kind of is possibly a phony or staff unit
Well, we can't comment too much on that. We don't think Zambia is making a big fight anyhow. Zambia has many of its people employed inside of Rhodesia, and if the whites of Rhodesia didn't give them any employment, there wouldn't be any money at all in Zambia. And if big countries like America force Zambia to go it alone, then we have to supply that go it money. And the result is that what they had previously as a rule or a regulation due to white leadership and due to the fact that the white man gave every bit of civilization that Zambia ever had to it. So actually, if they have taken it on like a person taking on a culture or a way of life, they may not know anything else either, say. So this might be that certain of its ruling class follow the Old Testament and the New. But they, of course, would have a sort of a strange doctrine. They wouldn't understand it as they would if they had the white leadership they used to have. And again, there'll be missionaries that'll be in there from America, and they may be permitted to teach them for a while. But Zambia is only a little small 2x4 country. Zambia doesn't have 2 million people, for that matter. We'll have time for another question.
Can you give any background on the World Bible Society?
The World Bible Society wants to put the Bible into every language, you mean?
I don't know.
Well, that's the only, of course, the American Bible Society has had one great fetish, and that is to get the Bible translated into every language and to get it out to every people. So they've been, throughout the years, doing just this, you know. And, of course, there's many tribes that don't have the money to get the Bible translated into it, but this has been their goal. In fact, the American Bible Society just run wild with the Bible. They get it in every language. They get it in every phase of
I saw a first publication I saw this week, and it's full of Latin.
It's full of what?
From Africa.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
That's what I wondered about exactly.
Well, I don't think it's got any. They just want to spread the Bible and let them go away. No, nothing wrong with it. However, we can apply ourselves more diligently to spreading the Bible properly. So this is it. Well, okay. We've talked, but you're now ahead.